supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Every day, 3,000 borrowers default on their federal student loans. It amounts to a serious unpaid bill for the government to the tune of $137 billion. For decades, the government has tried to get borrowers to pay up by hiring debt collection agencies to call and send letters. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, a new controversial strategy to collect on student loan debt is being ramped up in Philadelphia.
On Adrienne McNally's 49th birthday in January, she heard a knock on the door of her modest Northeast Philly row home.
I mean, they actually paid somebody to come out and serve me papers on a Saturday afternoon. Knocking at the door, I went to the door and he goes, sorry, just handed me the papers.
The government was suing her over the unpaid loans. Definitely an unwelcome birthday gift. But it's also an example of an experimental program the federal government has quietly brought to Philadelphia. If debt collectors don't work, officials are now suing to recover unpaid student loans.
Your whole body heats up with frustration because I'm so frustrated over all this. And it's been so many years that they've been sending me mail and threatening me on the phone.
She filed for bankruptcy in 2006 and cleared out all of her creditors except for the student loans, which are nearly impossible to discharge in bankruptcy. Before being sued, she was on a $130 a month payment plan, but she says that became unmanageable.
You're bringing up two kids and you're putting out that extra $130 a month. It really squeezes you.
Over the past decade, no more than 20 borrowers were sued every year for federal student loans in Philadelphia. But in the past 2 years, McNally and more than 200 others have faced lawsuits for falling behind on payments. Most of them are low-income residents like McNally. She took out the loans to go to beauty school in the 1980s, but it never worked out. The consequences of these suits are big. In nearly every one of them, the borrower loses and the government wins. And what do they win? A lien on their assets.
I describe a lien as like a marker on the house.
Jennifer Schultz is an attorney with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. She says if the borrower owns a home like McNally, it's like house handcuffs. They feel trapped. Because if they try to move, some of the proceeds will go to the federal government.
And so anytime a person tries to do a transaction involving their house, a new mortgage, a refinance, or if they try to sell it, they're going to be expected that they clear up any debt that's attached to that house.
Officials at the Department of Education and the Department of Justice would only communicate through written statements. What they told me is suing is their last option. They can already garnish wages, take income tax returns, and divert Social Security and disability benefits to student loan debt. Officials said they sue only when those methods don't work and when debt collectors are not successful. Still, they confirmed that in recent years, they've taken more than 5,400 student loan borrowers to court nationwide, but not by themselves. In Philadelphia, the government has hired a law firm that specializes in foreclosures and winning liens to carry out these suits. Critics call them a foreclosure mill. But those who work in the debt collection business say their work is diverse and shouldn't be demonized.
The lawyer who would portray that as predatory would be the first one to try to collect the support judgment for the little old lady.
Drew Salomon doesn't do student loan suits, but has spent his whole career as a debt collection attorney. He says the little old ladies deserve to have what they're owed back just as much as the government does. And he says some of the student loan borrowers are playing catch me if you can. So sometimes you gotta sue.
It's to try to awaken the avoider from their slumber.
But the end result of these suits, the liens, can be seriously threatening to borrowers. That's according to Joanna Darkus. She's an attorney who works in the student loan team at the National Consumer Law Center.
Fighting against these lawsuits is actually a matter of housing preservation. And for folks who are already living on the margins financially, the fear of losing that house can be palpable.
Once a lien is in place, the government can force a sale. Officials say that's super rare and it hasn't happened yet in Philadelphia, but advocates worry that with the lawsuit program expected to keep expanding, it's a very real possibility. Schultz, the attorney with Community Legal Services, says it's even more worrisome when you look at who is on the other side of these suits. people who took out small loans in the 1970s and 80s, a backlog of debt the government hopes to make into repayment revenue.
You're not talking about doctors and lawyers. You're talking about people who went to community colleges and trade schools, and maybe they were able to get themselves into secure jobs, but it seems like that many of them may not be paying those bills because their life didn't turn out that way.
Some are also concerned that the lawsuits are happening so fast that they might be ensnaring the wrong people. That's the situation Kevin Hatch says he's in. He's a part-time mechanic who owns a small house in Strawberry Mansion. He was recently sued by that foreclosure law firm on behalf of the federal government over a $3,000 student loan debt. But here's the thing. He says it has nothing to do with him.
I don't have that kind of money laying around to fork up like that.
In 1988, when the suit says he took out the loan, Hatch says he was working as a transmission repairman in Delran, New Jersey, not going to school.
I can understand them trying to get their money, but they're barking up the wrong tree. They're pursuing the wrong person.
But for the people who do legitimately owe back student loan debts, is it really worth it for the government? It's unclear what their return on investment is. Officials haven't yet responded to a request looking for a breakdown of what they're paying the private lawyers versus what they're recovering. But debt collector lawyer Salomon says it's likely worth it to them.
I think it's called loaves and fishes. If you cast enough bread upon the water, then some fishes nibble at it.
And there won't be a fish supply problem anytime soon, since more than 8 million people are currently behind on their federal student loans. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The New Jersey legislature is suing Governor Chris Christie over the process for obtaining a concealed carry permit in the Garden State. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
This all comes down to a few words, but they matter. If you wanted to carry a concealed gun in New Jersey, you had to show that there were specific threats against you to get a permit. For example, that you were a victim of domestic violence. But the governor expanded the qualifications to include serious threats not directed specifically at one person. Assembly Majority Leader Lou Greenwald says that means more guns in the hands of New Jerseyans.
You know, what the governor is articulating is if you're a pizza delivery person in an urban area where you believe that there's a high crime rate, you ought to be able to carry a gun and take public safety and law into your own hands.
On Friday, state lawmakers filed a lawsuit against Christie. They claim the rule change goes against legislative intent, and they're asking a judge to block it. A spokesman for Christie declined to comment on the lawsuit, but the governor is unlikely to stay quiet on this issue. Here's Christie on New Jersey 101.5 in December 2015.
Right now, we've got a situation, in our state at least, where it's easier for a bad guy to get a gun than it is for a good guy. It's just easier.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to follow the law. They don't care. They don't care.
Last summer, Christie had a simple message for state lawmakers blocking his push for less restrictive gun ownership. Quote, they're wrong, and we'll fight them. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
For the nearly 120,000 people living in the U.S. awaiting organ donations, word that New Jersey is considering offering tax credits to organ donors is welcoming news indeed. But the well-intentioned effort raises ethical questions, and for that, let's turn to Art Kaplan, head of medical ethics at NYU School of Medicine. Art, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, apparently 19 states either provide a tax credit or deduction for verifiable unreimbursed expenses related to living organ donations, though the New Jersey proposal has fewer, if any, strings attached. What are some of the implied potential pitfalls?
Well, there's no doubt that people who donate organs, whether a living person to another living person in need or someone whose sadly relative has died and they're making a cadaver donation, they shouldn't have expenses. They shouldn't incur costs. But a long time ago, we decided in this country to prohibit outright sale. So you can't sell your kidney. You can't sell your piece of your liver. And this law gets awfully close to violating the federal ban on organ sales. In other words, it's one thing to reimburse expenses if there are any. It's a different thing to hang out a shingle and say, hey, if you will donate when your loved one dies, you might get $1,000 or more.
I suppose the problems include coercion or that those with the least means who need the money would be more tempted to provide organs.
That's right. So the poor definitely going to be more attracted to things like a $1,000 benefit than the rich, and there's some worry in many circles that that means exploitation. But I think the real issue isn't that so much. It's undermining trust. So when somebody thinks, gee, I might be worth more to somebody else dead rather than alive, they get nervous about signing a card saying they want to be an organ donor. Fear is, if you get that money, when I'm dead, you're going to let me go quickly. You're not going to fight to keep me alive. You're not going to try hard to save me. It's an issue now. There are certainly people who don't sign their donor cards or don't register as an organ donor for fear that they're not going to get aggressive medical treatment. It just gets worse when you start to put a bounty on somebody's head. I should point out there's one other source of objection here. Many religious groups don't think you own your body, so they don't think you can sell it or get tax credits for it. One fear that I have is that if you do see some kind of a market, just flat-out payment for parts, come into existence, you're going to see powerful organizations like the Catholic Church start to oppose this because they're going to say, we oppose any market in body parts. And some may be saying, well, that's their right, but what do I care? But if you start to get us into a situation where large numbers of people won't donate organs because their church or their religious leaders say it's wrong to have a market, you could wind up losing more people as donors than you could be gaining by putting out a small financial incentive.
You said earlier you're referring to this country, but you've also served as co-director of the Joint Council of Europe UN study on trafficking organs and body parts. How does it work in other countries with what varying degrees of success?
Well, there's certainly markets in organs in many countries, India, the Philippines, Egypt, to cite but a few. There are many more. It's all black market. It's all under the table. And what you see time and again is people with a lot of debt, desperate, come in, sell a kidney. It's all living people, by the way. But then they quickly fall back into debt because they don't really get a job or a lifetime occupation. It's a one-shot infusion of money, and it isn't enough to work them out of their debt or their poverty, I'm going to say, three times out of four. The other problem with it is middlemen come in and start siphoning off the money so that by the time you're done, they wind up with very little or nothing. Presumably, a tax credit would work here, but that presumes you're paying taxes. And I'll say flat out, from what I've seen around the world, a $1,000 tax credit for people who are paying taxes, that is, have enough money to do that, I don't think it's going to sway hardly anyone into being an organ donor. Who had reservations about it before that kind of an incentive was put on the table. It's just not enough money.
Art Kaplan, thanks so much for helping us to think this through.
My pleasure.
Art Kaplan, head of medical ethics at New York University School of Medicine. It's estimated that millions of men were sexually abused as children, but stigma and denial often keep them silent about that abuse. A South Jersey man has come forward and shared his story, inspiring another survivor to reach out, all the way from Australia. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports.
In 2010, Rhett Hackett went on the Oprah Winfrey Show along with 200 men who'd also been molested as children. On social media, he said that he was willing to help anyone who needed it. 10,000 miles away, Tristan Iveson had also been sexually abused by an older man. His mother saw Hackett on TV and reached out to him.
First, I spoke to her, parent to parent, and then I had the opportunity to speak to Tristan, survivor to survivor.
Iveson was struggling at home.
I got lost. I got really lost in my own town, trying to sort of identify myself. Because these things here just put on an absolute stigma for me. I couldn't actually figure out who I was.
Iveson and Hackett have been talking for several years now. And connecting with someone who gets it has made a huge difference, Iveson says.
Being able to actually meet someone like Rhett, I didn't have to feel different. and that I didn't have to hide it, and I was able to work through those things and be myself.
Iveson is visiting Hackett right now in South Jersey to celebrate his 25th birthday.
He is a vision of hope right here because he will carry this forward. He'll parent differently. He's able to communicate the story.
Iveson says the trip has been a healing experience, and he wants to be a resource for other survivors, just as Hackett has helped him. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
There seem to be festivals for every kind of music, from classical in Aspen and Spoleto to acoustic music at the venerable Philadelphia Folk Festival. Two Philadelphia ensembles just performed at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee, that draws together everything from big rock groups to jazz to avant-garde classical. NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas caught up with them before they returned to Philadelphia.
It's hard to pin a label on the Big Ears Festival. First-time attender and performer Matt Levy plays saxophone with the Philadelphia-based Prism Quartet.
It's like a who's who of new music, covering not only classical new music, but rock, jazz. I like the idea that it looks at the relationship of all kinds of contemporary music and how those musics influence each other.
This year, Prism and another Philadelphia ensemble, the Crossing Choir, made their debut in this eclectic mix. Choir director Donald Nally says that while they've always thought of themselves as diverse, he's glad to be acknowledged that way by others.
Sort of pinching myself to think that we have a choir that is seen as versatile enough to be included in this, and yet at the same time invited to sing in a church in New York. There's a lot of texture to the work, and Big Ears, I think, really, really magnifies that.
Their shared concert bill included The Fifth Century by British composer Gavin Bryars. It was commissioned by The Crossing, specifically for the Icebox Performance Space in Philadelphia's Northern Liberties neighborhood.
We had wanted to do a commission with Prism for a long time. We thought this was a good project for it because Gavin knows how to write for saxes, and he's a very vocal writer, but he knows what the possibilities are at the kind of at the fringes of the possibilities, and he goes for it.
Bryars' music, both vocal and instrumental, is marked by a slow unfolding melody.
Something that evolves slowly. In a way, it gives a kind of human pace for a listener, too. I just love the kind of the fact that you could have something so slow that it still swings. It's not static, it's still moving.
For the Fifth Century, Matt Levy says Bryars worked to highlight musical sensibilities of both the groups.
Prism and the Crossing playing together, there's this sort of effect we have on one another where the sounds kind of meld. And I think Gavin Bryars has found this magical way of integrating saxophones and voices. It's sort of a synergy that this piece really exploits beautifully.
With busy schedules and members spread out in many different places, the performers and composers say they appreciated the rare opportunity to hear a 45-minute work like The Fifth Century. Gavin Bryars.
It was the first time I've heard it live since I heard it in concert in the Icebox there. You know, that's the last time I heard them perform live in front of an audience.
For those who missed the performances, they recorded The Fifth Century at the Curtis Institute and released it this winter on ECM Records. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
There are a few widely recognized rules of etiquette for those trying to sell a home. Always be courteous toward potential buyers. Dress appropriately. Highlight the positives while downplaying the negatives. Avoid foul language. In other words, don't be this guy.
You come inside, you got a living room, right? I got to tell you more of that. You got a dining room where you eat like a pig slob that you are, right? You got a kitchen, granite countertops. Who the cares, right? Here, you got a kitchen and eating room, and here's a deck and a back, right? Here's where you watch TV, you fat bastards.
Well, that's Joey Pizzo in a homemade video trying to sell his deceased parents' Mays Landing, New Jersey home. Pizzo calls his style South Philly original, and his video has over 500,000 views on YouTube, though at last check, he'd yet to receive an offer on the house. Philadelphians turn to 311, the city's non-emergency contact center, to find out when trash is collected or how to request services such as a pothole repair or removal of an abandoned vehicle. But you may not know what happens between the time when you call and when the problem is addressed. We're inviting Tim Thornton, director of Philly 311, to join us on NewsWorks Tonight this Friday to field your questions about the history and purpose of the department, its range of services, and improvements to customer feedback. You can join the conversation by calling our comment line at 484-800-1311. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.